My name's Paul Bestall, and you're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. The world is a possibility, if you'll only try. Welcome to episode 4 of Mysteries and Monsters, and I'm joined today by former policeman Andy Gilbert. Andy released his first book, Credible Witness, last year, and we discuss several of the cases in the book. When it comes to tales of the paranormal or fantastical, we often give more credit to witness reports from qualified people. Be they airline pilots spotting UFOs or strange lights in the sky, cryptid sightings by hunters or biologists, or even haunted houses visited by police. These experiences are often elevated by the witness's profession. Andy discusses the cases in his book, all taken from fellow police officers from around the UK. And you can find the book on Amazon, both as a physical, paperback copy, and on Kindle. Don't forget, you can now find the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn and Podbean. Like the page on Facebook. You can also follow us on Instagram and Twitter and support us on Patreon. Now, time for the interview. Right, so I'm joined today by author Andy Gilbert, who's a former police officer with the West Midlands Police. And he's recently written a fabulous book entitled Credible Witness, which is a collection of incidents and strange goings-on reported by police officers during Andy's time with the West Midlands Police, and obviously a few stories from around the rest of the country. So thank you for joining me today, Andy.
Absolute pleasure.
Excellent. So how did you get to this point? What was the catalyst for you to kind of say, right, I'm going to write a book about these stories and where it went from there?
Well, it started when often when you're sort of a police officer, like working nights in the early hours, you get the odd down moments, and you might be, I was off, parked up in a you know, in a police car with a colleague, and just as conversation, I'd say, have you ever seen a ghost? And most of the times people would say no, but on other occasions people would say yes, and they'd explain the story. I just found it quite interesting, and then roll on, fast forward to probably when I was working at Warsaw. And how long ago? That was probably, about 8 years before I actually retired, left the police. I was the duty inspector, and there was an incident that came through where a security guard at a newly constructed residential place for old people had called up because he thought people were breaking. The report came through that there were people on the premises, so quite naturally, several officers went there as quickly as they could. And we were met by a youngish security guard who said that he was sitting there. The light started going, flashing off and on, off and on, off and on. And then when he walked into the recreation area, he saw an old couple ballroom dancing. And then they disappeared. And we just thought, oh, my word, what sort of thing is, you know, what's going on here? Yeah. So quite naturally, we checked the rest of the premises. They were at the stage where nobody was actually moved in yet. Mm. It was just, they were just finishing off the final touches and what have you.
Yeah.
And so we went down the whole premises and with him to check everything was secure and that nobody had been in there. And quite clearly, this was a genuine young lad and he was very, very concerned about what he'd seen. Mm. An old couple ballroom dancing, it just seemed so bizarre.
Yeah,
I mean...
Oh, sorry, Andy.
No, carry on then.
I was just going to say, because that, like I said, that's an extremely unusual thing for anybody to see in general.
Yeah, and it had been preceded by the lights going off and on. And he was clearly very frightened. And a few nights later, I was out with a colleague who I'd been with, and I said, should we just call in and see the security guard just to make sure he's all right, just to reassure you. And I was by another security guard, and that the previous one, he'd given up the job. That, you know, the next day he wasn't going back there. And I, you know, that was, I think it was probably 4 or 5 years later when I retired, and I started just doing a little bit of writing in between. Mm. And I thought, well, this would be an interesting subject, because I knew of people who'd had incidents. Mm. So I contacted them first of all, and then just using social media, and then when I was just out and about or bumping into people, I just started asking that question. Yeah. And the response I got was how the book ended up.
Yeah, I mean, I've got the book. When I heard you interviewed last year, I was just blown away by some of the stories that were discussed, and I just thought there always seems to be some kind of, I don't know whether you, police officers or anybody in the emergency services, if they seem or are involved in something that's paranormal in origin, it seems to be given a bit more credence, if you understand my meaning, in regards to the fact that, you know, you guys are trained observers. It's, you know, part of your role is to take as many details as possible in a variety of investigations. So you know, it's part of your basic training, isn't it? To basically, take in the environment and observe your surroundings at all times.
Well, that's right. And, you know, there's nothing wrong in being sceptical, because that's a good position to be in, because you question everything. I think with the format, that there's like the ABC of investigation, you know, accept nothing, believe no one, confirm everything. And just by when some of these situations arose with them, quite often they would start the story with, I don't believe in the paranormal, but, and then they would tell me the story and they say, I can't explain it. By applying those, but, you know, well, this is what I saw. This is what happened. There's no doubt in my mind this is what happened, but I cannot explain it. And I suppose the battleground between the scientific side and the spiritual side will always go on, but it will never be solved because I don't think it ever will be, because you can apply physics and say, well, there's no possible way that there could be anything such as a ghost. But I know for a fact that the people I've spoken to are absolutely genuine, you know, and they know what they've seen. And they've, you know, when you see somebody walk through a wall, you know you've seen a ghost. It could not be anything else.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other thing here is, as well as, you know, as in any kind of industry or role of you know, when you're working in the emergency services, is these are not the kind of things that you want to put yourself out of. You know, and speaking to your colleagues and saying, oh, you know, have you heard about this? Because, you know, you're going to get ribbed for the rest of your career.
Yeah, there was an awful lot of that. There is a stigma involved, particularly in, obviously, something like the police, because your professional reputation could be in tatters very, very early doors if you were a young officer. And I had one of those cases with, it was the Three Tons Inn in Sutton Coldfield, which has got some history in terms of hauntings and ghosts and what have you. And I was just out for a drink, and I just bumped into this guy who'd also retired. And I said, well, Neil, that's what you're doing. I said, I'm just working on this book at the moment. And he, you know, he gave me sort of a really. And then he pulled me to one side and said, well, look, something happened to me. And he said, I don't discuss it, but I'll contact you tomorrow and I'll send you all the details. It turned out that he was on foot patrol, walking around the back of the Three Tons pub, which is by Sutton Coldfield Town Hall, when this ghostly figure of a cavalier, he feels his thing, watch, he sees this ghostly figure of a cavalier in the window, and he thinks, well, that's not right. So he looks again. This is quite often this happens. They all, well, it's not just something, you know, I'm not seeing things. He looked again, and then he saw that ghostly figure come from beyond the building, coming towards him, floating towards him. And quite that, your natural reaction is, well, his was, he just ran down the hill. But he couldn't tell anybody. You can't get up on the radio and say, you know, Sarge, I've just been chased by a guy, a ghost. For that very reason, it would stick, you know, for the rest of your career. Oh, that's the bloke who saw the ghost, you know. So it's quite a dilemma that people were put in. So I was very sort of honoured that people had trusted me enough to tell me these stories for perhaps the first time.
Absolutely. And I mean, obviously, you know, reading the book, you know, virtually every single person that's come forward to you, there obviously is a level of anonymity in regards to, you know, wanting to tell their story, but obviously, you know, protect their identities, which is fine. But one of the things that struck me most throughout the book was the variety of experiences that people had opened up about, you know. I mean, there are stories involving poltergeists, crisis apparitions. You've got strange smells. I mean, you've even got an animal in one, which I always find, you know, paranormal sightings of animals as a really strange, you know, not that I'm saying ghosts are pretty normal, but I think when you bring animals into a sighting or a haunting, then that's just on a different level.
Yeah, it is. And I would just going back slightly, I would say some of the people involved were absolutely said to me, I haven't got any issue. You can put my name to it. Mm. I know what happened and I'll stand by it. But just for consistency, there were some that were a little bit. Yeah. And I thought, well, just, you know, I'll just mention their first names. But yeah, there was one with the horse that was seen in Solly Hall with the rider on that just went across in front of a car. Now, also in the book, a lot of the stories are corroborated. There were two officers who actually saw it. So it's not one person seeing it being mistaken. But they saw like a highwayman on a horse come across the road straight in front of them from hedge to hedge. Mm. And the officer actually turned to his colleague and he knew that he'd seen, you know, a highwayman on a horse. But he didn't say, so he just thought, well, hang on, am I going crazy? So he said, did you see that? And his friend, his colleague said, yes. It was a man on a horse. I thought, yeah, we both saw the same thing. I think there's a couple of stories in there, like, you know, the Victorian lady at, I think it's Whitworth Manor in Wolverhampton. Yeah. They've both seen it, you know, and they both know what they've seen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's one, the first story that really, because, you know, I like being spooked, and I like to think that, you know, I've got quite a high scare factor. It takes a lot to get my the hairs standing up on the back of my neck. But there's one particular story, the first one I read in the book, that really made my hair stand on end, is the one about the car chase in the north of Birmingham. With the officer, I think he was in a Montego.
Yeah, that's right. He came. Yeah. That's when that one came through. It was. He did the same with me, really. Because he said, I've got a story for you. And when I heard it, I thought, you know, well, crikey, that's really, you know, that's quite profound in what he'd seen. And again, there were two officers who saw it. There was the car chase and they saw the car roll over and crash. And he saw the, you know, police, they call it, you know, starburst when the people get out the car and run. You know, the first reaction is, people often see situations where they see like a dude in a car crash and go, oh, no one's going to walk out of that. But they often do get out and run. Yeah. I suppose it's with the adrenaline and what have you.
Yes.
And in this case, he saw that car turn over and a lamppost crash on it. And he saw a person run from the car. He had to brake to avoid him. He nearly sort of ran over him. Mm. And he recognised him straight away because he was a well-known sort of offender for that sort of crime, as did his colleague. And of course, he gets on the radio and starts naming the offender and saying, you know, and the other officers who were involved in the pursuit said, what are you talking about? This is, well, no one's got out of that car. What on earth are you talking about? You know, it's upside down with a lamppost on it.
Yeah.
And he becomes quite frustrated. But he names the person, says, so-and-so just run from the car. And then obviously subsequently the fire brigade come, cut the car open, and there's the person that the officer had named deceased in the car.
That's incredible because you've got all the ingredients of that story. You've got the, you know, obviously the car chase with the driver being pursued. You've got two cars chasing him. The other two officers in the other car join the chase. Obviously, see what happens. And like you say, the story is, I mean, the whole thing about the story is they see the crash, they see the incident, they then see someone get out of the car and run off. I think they run across into some, is it wasteland or parkland, I think they make their escape.
Yeah, they've run across once the car into some, off into some parkland, yeah.
But none of that makes sense because, I mean, yeah, fair enough, one person's seen it and he's able to recognise it. It's an uncorroborated event and maybe somebody would say, oh, well, perhaps due to the shocking incident, it's some kind of secondary reaction or something like that. But two people wouldn't suffer the same sort of response to that kind of incident, I would imagine, because it's not something that I would imagine officers are not used to seeing.
No, it's not. But they went through, you know, it would be in the, you know, what you would do if you saw an offender that you knew.
Mm.
It would be normal police practice for you to say, the offender responsible for this is, and he's just ran off. And that's what he did straight away. He identified the person he'd seen run in front of his car.
Yeah.
And yet that person hadn't run in front of his car because that person was actually deceased, still within the wreck.
Yeah, I mean, that just, and I just went, whoa, I had to put the book down for a minute.
Yeah.
I just thought, right,
yeah.
let me just get a grip here. Because like I say, that was just... It's on a different level as far as I'm concerned. I mean, you know, no disrespect to any of the stories in the book, because I think they're all fabulous. But that one is just, there's just something about it that just, you know, the two witnesses, the incident, what happened, and the fact that, you know, it basically when the fire brigade turned up, you know, the car's concertinaed and that's that. It that just blew my mind.
Yeah, and I've known that officer a long time, and I've known him years and years, and he'd never spoke about this with me until I was looking for, you know, I said I was doing what I was doing. And very capable, very nice guy, very pragmatic, you know. And there's absolutely no way I would doubt a word that he told me.
Yeah. It's just, I mean, there are so many stories like that in the book, and I found as I went through it, that, you know, some of them were just getting extremely creepy. I mean, another one that jumped out to me is the one where the I think it's a lady officer takes a call about from a motorist who's seen a motorcyclist.
I think he was a gent in the Staffordshire control room who saw the motorcyclist. Yeah, that's right, yeah. On the surface station.
Mm.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
The ghostly hitchhiker story, because for me, it's kind of, obviously it's not the same, but it's that kind of situation where there's somebody at the side of the road in some form of, you know, needing help or distress. A good Samaritan stops to help them, and then they end up having an experience that just, you know, just terrifies them.
Yeah, yeah, and they can't explain, but there, you know, it was all recorded on a police log. That, you know, gent who picked him up, again, normal, regular guy, absolutely genuine, but obviously very shaken up by what had happened. There's an awful lot of... there is a variety of incidents that happen, and, I just found it fascinating. I found it fascinating so much so that I'm now well into producing another book.
I mean, that's the thing as well. I would imagine, obviously, since the book's come out, has it kind of garnered a, you know, people getting in touch with you and thinking, well, because reading the book, you know, like we were saying earlier on about protecting people's identities and treating each case, you know, based, you know, on an honest telling, and just putting the story out there for the readers to enjoy. Has that kind of allowed more officers to feel comfortable coming forward to talk to you about their experiences and feel comfortable in discussing them with you?
I think it has. I mean, I've done a few podcasts and I've done some local radio, and then as a result of those, people have got in touch with me with stories and what have you, and said, oh, you know, I've said after the radio show and various things, I said, well, oh, if only you told me about that, you know. But of course, I recorded it down, and as I went along, oh, what are you doing? I said, I did. Oh, you know, and so I probably got a quarter of what would be sort of a reasonable amount of content for a book. But and they were all really interesting stories, and I thought, well, what do I do with these? So after Christmas, I contacted all the retired police associations throughout the country. I thought, I'm going to have to, the stories are out there, I'm going to have to go and see if I can find them. And I emailed them all, and they put it out in various newsletters, and the response I had has been fantastic. So some really interesting stories. Again, the variety, like, completely different from the first one, but equally as interesting.
Absolutely. So have you managed to get a few more areas getting in touch? Because obviously the first book, through your experiences, is mostly based around the Midlands and the outlying areas. And I know there's a couple of stories from other parts of the country. But has it given you a bigger scope of stories to come from different federations?
Yes, it has. I've got stories from, you know, Northumberland, Durham, right down to, you know, Sussex, Suffolk, Cardiff. So yeah, there's a good spread across the country of stories, and they're still coming in. I've just been writing one up tonight, and of course this is done for a local charity in Burntwood, and so I don't, you know, the royalties, I don't make any money from it. Nobody who takes part in it has anything to get out of it other than they just, you know, they come forward to tell their story. So there's no kudos involved. When they contact me, I either speak to them in person or they've emailed me. And I know, you know, these are genuine stories from people. And as I say, they're quite often telling them for the first time. But I'm really pleased that, you know, we're getting these stories down, because some stories need to be told, because it's whatever we think we know, we don't know everything. And as every story comes in, you think, there's always a slight difference in them. There's nothing that's exactly the same as another story. So it's fascinating.
Yeah, I think that's sometimes the danger when you do a collection like this, is that sometimes you occasionally will spot, and maybe you've come across a couple already, you tend to spot certain urban myths where it's a well-known story, and it often gets repeated. But that was one of the other things about the first book, was that there didn't seem to be any of those stories. I know I alluded to the incident with the motorcyclist and the phantom hitchhiker kind of story, but that even that in itself is quite different to the standard, you know, lady by the side of the road. So have you come across that kind of thing, or have you been surprised by the originality of what you're being told?
Well, what I wanted was, you know, a first-hand account. So I wanted to have that sort of, you know, that credible witness there, you know, so I wanted what they saw. I didn't want second-hand information, or, you know, rumour has it this, rumour has it that. And because there's a million and one stories in the police, as there is in, you know, people who work in schools, factories, there's a million and one of those stories about, you know, oh, it's haunted. and that there's no real sort of benefit in that. An example of that would be Canterbury Road Police Station in Perry Bar. There are loads of stories about, you know, people hearing noises, et cetera, et cetera, anecdotal stuff. But I did get two stories down that were, I think they were probably about 30 years apart, about a cell door slamming for no reason. Now, so that sort of, they sort of corroborate each other. And because, okay, you can hear noises in an old building when it's warming down, cooling up. But the sound of a cell door slamming, metal on metal, that's quite distinctive. But what pleased me with Canterbury Road is, for the second book, I've now spoken to an officer who has seen the Canterbury Road ghost. And this is the first time, you know, because lots of people have said, oh, I heard this, I heard that, I just didn't feel this, I didn't feel that, which is, okay, that's fine, I don't dispute it. But now I've spoken to an officer who's actually seen the Canterbury Road ghost, so I was really pleased about that.
Wow, so that's basically, that's the first time somebody's kind of said, oh, because obviously, like you said, you know, we've had bangings and slammings and such, but it's the first time somebody's come forward and actually seen a physical apparition.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah.
So I was really pleased about that.
I can imagine, I bet. I mean, that's the other thing about that, you know, like going back to what you were saying about the door slamming. You know, a cell door's not, I mean, I would imagine you have to give that some real welly to create a slam that, you know, that can resonate around a police station.
Yeah, and the clang is, you know, it's that metal on metal and it rings, you know. So
yeah, that's not a draft that can probably cause that.
That's not. It's not a creak. It's not a noisy radiator. It's not something creaking. You know, it can only be one thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was the other thing about the butler. You know, like, as I mentioned, there are so many different things. You know, you've got the tobacco store. You know, the guy that was having a crafty fag, and you could smell the tobacco. Which you know, when you've got a you know other kind of environmental responses other than you know sight and sound, I think when smell comes into it, that also takes it into a different kind of level of an experience, because you know if it's just you know whichever theory you consider that you know for the reason for ghosts, like we discussed earlier about you know we're not trying to solve what they are, we're just very interested in this subject, but when it comes to, you know, an aroma or a smell, especially something as distinctive as tobacco is in this, you know, non-smoking era that we're in these days, that's quite a distinctive thing to come across.
Yeah, it is. When there's, like you say, when there's other senses involved, it's really interesting. It, you know, particularly like you say, when there's no smoking, but you can smell the strong, distinctive smell of tobacco. And another thing that I've been increasingly interested in, there's a couple of incidences in the book where I think there's one where there's a police dog involved, and it's the reaction of the police dog, you know, that animals may have a sense around when something isn't right. Hmm. And certainly since I've been getting material for the second book, I think there's two or three occasions where there's a dog involved, and that dog knows, you know, the dog is behaving in a way that it doesn't normally behave. And he's not going to go any further, and so I think that's always an interesting side to it, I feel.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, because the perception in general is that animals have this kind of, you know, sixth sense that, you know, the hackles will come up, or they'll, you know, they'll basically act in an unusual way where, you know, as I would imagine the handler at the time, as far as they're concerned, there is nothing to be perturbed by.
Yeah.
I mean, and that once again, you know, especially a handler and his dog, they've got that kind of relationship. They will, you know, be quite, I would imagine, obviously they know that dog, how it works, the way it works, and what makes it tick. So when it reacts in an unusual way, I suppose that then causes them to think, hello, what's going on here?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I do have a story just like that. Although the dog was behaving really badly, not badly, but the dog was really obviously concerned. The dog was really sort of spooked by what was going on. And yet the handler wasn't. Yet it seemed a couple of minutes later, whatever the dog was feeling, the handler felt it. Despite not, it was just overwhelming, you know, we need to get out of here, you know. Yeah. So maybe the dog just picked it up quicker than the human did.
That would not be a good. I mean, it's bad enough if the dog starts playing up, but yeah, I would imagine. I would suggest that that's probably the best thing. That you know, the heightened senses of an animal are obviously a bit more attuned to their environment, and it may have taken a couple of minutes for that feeling to kind of overwhelm the officer involved. I mean, it's just such a fabulous collection, and I'm delighted to hear you're doing another volume. So it was honestly probably one of the best books I read last year in regards to the paranormal. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thanks very much. I'm really pleased about that.
Yeah. Well, it was just full of really nice stories. And like, you know, there's most of it is ghosts. But like I say, you know, we've got apparitions, we've got cell. You've got a really good spread of, you know, your archetypal historical hauntings, you know, as we refer to the you know, the ballroom dancing couple and the cavalier coming out the pub door. But then you've also got, you know, fairly modern ones as well. So there doesn't seem to be rhyme or reason, does there? Just, you know, if you just seem to have to, well, not necessarily the right place at the right time, probably the wrong place at the right time, but still.
I genuinely wanted to treat it. It is a sensitive subject, and perhaps a little bit more so in the second book, but certainly in the first book as well. I had to anonymise certain things because, you know, there were spirits of, you know, people that were known, and obviously you have to think about the relatives.
Yes.
And it is a sensitive subject, and I've tried to treat it with, you know, respect, and just treat it for what it is. I think it's just part and parcel of everyday life, you know. I am aware now that there are some people who are more sensitive to perhaps these things because they seem to have a number of events they told me about, not in the book, but they're saying, throughout, you know, not police related, but they seem to have other things happen to them, and they tend to accept it.
Yeah. I think maybe that is that, because there is a you know, a real train of thought in paranormal discussion and investigation that obviously certain people are more attuned to picking things up, and obviously if that affects everybody in the everyday walks of life, then that for me would obviously carry over into the police force, that you've got a vast array of people and backgrounds and personalities and lifestyles, that there will obviously be a certain amount of people amongst officers that would be more sensitive, I would suggest.
Yeah, and also I noticed the number of ex-military, military service personnel. I don't know why, but they just seem to be, whether or not it's because the nature of the work that they've done takes them, you know, into an awful lot of danger. But I had some good stories from ex-servicemen.
Maybe that could be because, you know, they've been trained in an environment where they have to be fully aware of all danger around them, that maybe their senses have become heightened in some extreme.
Yeah, and particularly with the Woolworth story. I know that, I think I just put out on social media, when I was doing the book, I had a story from Woolworths, and I think someone just left a comment. They said, there's no such thing as ghosts. There's just oversensitive people or something like that.
Yeah.
And I contacted that person. I said, look, the person who provided me with that story is a former Royal Marine. He is a former boxer. He is as hard as nails.
Yeah.
He's the most down-to-earth person that you could ever meet, you know. And if something has scared him, and he's told me that he's seen what he's seen, I said, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind, you know, that this is the truth, because he's not a shrinking violet and he's not somebody who scares easily. In fact, he says, I'm not scared of any man, but I didn't see a man. I saw something else, you know. And if something makes him run out the building, then, you know.
Yeah, I think I'd have been gone about 30 seconds before he did, to be honest. I think he wouldn't have seen me for dust, I'm afraid. I think Andy going out of there, because that once again, you take that story then for me with more credence because of that man's background and what he's experienced and what he knows. You think, blimey, that guy's clearly seen something that's, you know, put the willies up in.
Yeah, and that's a person that does not scare easily.
Yeah. I mean, have you kind of had a situation, because I was talking to a couple of authors from Canada the other day, and that we got into the discussion about when people have an incident or they experience something. Some people tend to then notice things a lot more going forward. So have you found any officers have kind of had more than one incident based on one happening, or is it just a, you know, these are just a story from a collection of people and nobody seems to be getting a repeat?
No, I don't think anybody's had a repeat of the incident that they've had. But some of the people that have told me things have told me other things that haven't gone in the book. They've said, like, you know, well, this also happened where I lived and what have you, but it wasn't relevant to the main subject matter of being police related. But a lot of these things are just, you know, some people say, I've seen this, I don't believe in the paranormal, this happened, I can't explain it. I don't think their view's changed. I think they've got an open mind, but they cannot believe what they've seen, but they know what they've seen. So I suppose unless you've been in that situation, it's very difficult to know how you sort of deal with it and how you sort of work it out in your own mind about, you know, what's just happened there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, it's a lot to do with, you know, you can meet people who you know, one person may say, well, I've clearly seen a ghost, whereas some other person will just try and compartmentalise it and say, right, well, it must have been this, or it's because of this. It's still, for some instances, it just doesn't give you a satisfactory explanation, really, does it?
No, and that's I think the great mystery that however much we think we know about this world and universe, I don't think we know everything, and I don't think we ever will. Yeah. That's why it's very difficult to say that you can be an expert in this sort of field, because how can you be if there's so many unknowns and there's you can't, you know, however skeptical you are or however dismissive people can be, all these people are not wrong. You know, they're not all wrong, they're not all mistaken. It's not a draft, it's not a trick of the light. You can go through the whole checklist of reasons why it's something else, but it doesn't fit. You know, they know what they've seen, and they know what they've felt, and they know what the situation was.
Absolutely. And I mean, they've had to deal with that kind of situation. Like you were, you know, you're referring, a lot of people will often say, oh, you know, if this happened to me, I'd react in this certain manner. But like you say, until it happens to you, you honestly got no idea how you're going to deal with that situation, regardless of, you know, whether it's a strange light in the sky, or you see something in a house that shouldn't be there, or, you know, or you see a man on a horseback riding across the street in front of you.
Yeah.
And the, you know, these are situations that it's all well and good saying, oh, well, I'll do this. But I think when you're in that situation, what you will do just completely goes out of the mind.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of the times they try to investigate what they've seen. You know, they've, what I've just seen, you know, I've just seen a man in a police cape walk past me. And I've spoken to him, he's ignored me. Then I've turned around and lo and behold, but where's he gone? He cannot, you know, I've checked every door. He cannot have gone anywhere. There's only me in this building. What is it that I've just seen? You know, they check it out, and then often there's a gradual dawning of, well, they start to feel uncomfortable then, because they know that they've seen something that there was probably a ghost.
Yeah, the realization begins to kick in, yeah. I think, there, Andy, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I have had stories of that when they say, well, yeah, after I'd checked everywhere, I decided to go outside and eat my sandwiches in the car. Perfectly normal human reaction, you know.
Very much so, yeah. I can't get out of this building quick enough, I think is the general consensus there. I think one of the other stories I love in the book, which is another one that the hairs on the back of the neck, I think when anything else is involved, like a secondary reaction, and it's the signal box story near Crewe with the telephone call.
Yeah.
Now that, once again, you've got, a physical entity being affected by something that, you know, well, please tell us more.
It was a recording from a call came through, and they traced the call to a signal box that no longer existed, calling for help. And they went through all the usual things of tracing the call, tracing the number, sending British Transport Police officer to the location. But it's obviously that, I mean, do they call these time slips? There'd been some sort of time slip where a message had come through from somewhere that no longer existed. And there was a proper, you know, I think there's a number of people in the Transport Police who know about this, because they all saw the log, the incident log printed out, and they were talking about it for days. But yeah, I found that to be a very, very interesting story.
I mean, that kind of thing, it's basically like a cry for help from the past. And, you know, we often come across stories of, you know, wailing ghosts who have been wrong, you know, murdered in hundreds of years ago. Or I think there's a very famous story from Australia about a ghost called Frank who got murdered, and his ghost allegedly got his revenge by pointing out where the murderer had left his body. Famously, I've forgotten his surname now, but I think it's called Frank Field or something, and it's a 200 year old story. So that's always kind of fascinated me, that kind of situation where you have an incident that's happened where we still have a ripple from that original incident still bounding down through time.
Yeah. And like I say, it's like I say, they call them time slips, the ripple, you know, is on some sort of loop, you know, but it happened, you know, and it's, yeah, again, you can't explain the unexplainable, but it's very real, because they went through the usual process of tracing the call, doing everything they could, and it's like, well, what's going on here? This is just bizarre. you know.
Yeah, it's, I mean, like I said, there's many of the stories I've read in the book where I'm just baffled, and I'm, you know, very open-minded, and it's one of those things when I've, because I've had an interest in the paranormal and Fortean subjects for quite a long time, and I've always viewed any case where police officers have been involved, whether they've been called to a house or an incident, that it takes it to a different level. Have you, through, you know, as this kind of new career for you, as it were, have you kind of thought about looking into some of the cases, well, you know, very well known cases where we've had police officers involved? I'm thinking, you know, perhaps one that springs to mind is the Enfield poltergeist from the late 70s in London.
To be honest, no, I don't see myself as an investigator. I see myself as just the conduit for other people to, you know, to get these stories out there.
Mm.
Because I don't feel that if every story that came in, I tried to either prove or disprove, I think I'd probably drive myself crazy. And I could never do it either way, for the simple reason is I wasn't there and they were.
Mm.
They were the witness, you know, and I've no reason to doubt them. I do like try and you know, and look for background and what have you. And quite often I find some corroboration that they've, that the what's been told is not the only person that may have experienced something.
Mm.
In fact, I've just contacted a journalist in the Northeast because I was given a story from Durham, and so I did some background work, and lo and behold, he's done an article on it involving the same location. So it's, no, I don't think to investigate.
Mm.
What I do is I give you the witness statement, so to speak. These could be transferable. This is a witness statement. This is what this person saw, felt, heard.
Hmm.
And I never tried to disprove it because I couldn't.
Yeah. I mean, there are a couple of stories like, as we've just been discussing, the signal box, where you've done some secondary research on the back of it to get a bit more historical context. And I think the Woolworths story is another one where you've kind of looked into the history of that particular, you know, that particular location. So
I might have misunderstood. Yeah, I do some of that research around it, but another one was the Bishopsgate one. The nurse Evelyn. Now I did some on that because the story came through that as it was like in like a written statement from the officer.
Hmm.
And so then I did some research, and then I found about the bombing that had taken place when the nurse Evelyn had unfortunately been killed in the war.
Hmm.
Then I contacted an officer who works at Bishopsgate.
Hmm.
He told me, yep, absolutely, there's lots of stories about it. And Evelyn is this sort of nurse who is believed to be sort of carrying on her good work. She's just, you know, I don't think she'd be frightened. Obviously, it's very frightening for the person there, but it seems like she doesn't mean anybody any harm. She's just carrying on doing what she always did. But he then sent me a picture of her, and then I looked at the picture and compared it with the description that I'd had from the officer, and it was the sort of, you know, the John Lennon spectacles and the high lace collar. And I thought, oh my word, you know, everything tied in, you know, from the different sources. And that just, I don't put pictures in the book because it costs me too much money then. And obviously I'm trying to raise it. But it's just the reason I don't put pictures in, because it bumps up the production costs, and I'm trying to get as much money for the charity.
Absolutely.
But yeah, when I saw that, I thought, oh my word, that spooked me a little bit.
Yeah, but I think also as well, you know, regardless of the financial implication, I think sometimes if someone says, gives you a description, and then someone, essentially, if somebody says, oh, it looks like that, regardless of whether you basically then focus on the image rather than the description.
Yeah.
So I think that gives the stories even more credit, because you don't do that, and it, you know, there's no drawings of wraiths or spectres wandering about in between the stories or anything. It's just basically, here's the story, here's what I've been told, there you are.
And people just have to, if you like, I'm asking people to trust me, because I trust the people that I've spoken to. There's no clowns or joking around, you know. Hence the title, these are credible witnesses.
Absolutely.
And I think a lot of, they deserve a lot of credit for having the courage to share their stories with me, because I know that in some cases it has been difficult and it's been quite emotional for some people.
Yeah.
In talking to me, they have genuinely got emotional because this is something that's been on their mind for a long time. So,
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, the other great thing I like about the book, as you've referred to there, is that, you know, these stories are, as you know, essentially as they happen, and whether that's because these people are police officers, there's no fluff in this. Do you know what I mean? There's no kind of exaggeration or people basically dressing it up. They're basically saying this is something extremely odd. This is exactly what happened, which I also found extremely refreshing in how you've collated the stories, Andy.
Well, I got one bad review, and that was somebody not complaining about the stories, complaining about the language used in the book. And I just thought, well, if something really frightening happened, you know, most of us would probably use a little bit of choice language.
Absolutely.
And if that's what they said when it happened, then that's what went in the book. You know, I'm not there to make it look, I'm not there to sort of, you know, make it look better. I'm not there to make it look worse. I'm just telling you, this is their story. This is what they said. And I think some choice language is quite a natural reaction when you're scared out of your skin.
If anything, it proves that they have been completely taken aback in the situation.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I didn't find the language too. If anything, it made me chuckle. Honest. I think the is it the UFO, the Aldridge sighting, the UFO.
Oh yes.
And I think the officer who's told the story, I think he uses one of my favourite phrases. You know, that's bollocks.
Yes.
Because
yes.
of that one. Yes. I mean, that's another story that I absolutely loved in that. So. Can you tell me a bit more about that and how this all transpired for this chap to end up proclaiming he wasn't very impressed by what had gone on?
Well, that is from a retired chief inspector, and at the time there was an awful lot of publicity. There was a lot of media coverage, and he was on local television. But of course, it's all pre-internet, so when you go googling around for it, you don't find much. But because I knew how to get hold of him, and I said, can you send me the chapter and verse of it? He was quite happy to do so. Mm. And it was without doubt, it wasn't just the police that saw it. There's a lot of residents who actually saw this object in the sky. Mm. And it was quite clearly that it was something that was manufactured. It wasn't, it was definitely a spaceship UFO of some kind. Mm. And of course, once he had a camera and he took some pictures, and it went off. And I think in the book I actually refer to, there's another UFO sightings book that sort of corroborates this actual object on that day.
Yeah.
And then the next day he's summoned up to see the chief constable, and the men in suits are there, and the photographs are developed, and he hands them over and off they go. And then the only ones they released for the actual press release, he said, were the ones that weren't very good. And he said he knew he had some very good photographs of that object, some very good ones, but they didn't release those to the press. And then they tried to create some story about, I can't remember now, but like he said, that that's bollocks. He knew what he'd seen. And so did it. And so did everybody else, But that's that's one of the best sightings of a UFO. In the Midlands, that is. So I was delighted to be able to, to get straight to that witness and have, let him tell the story, without any, as he wanted to.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know how, but when you've gone through that kind of situation, I can imagine it just really changes your opinion about your role or the fact that clearly something is going on, because if you're in that position and you know what you've seen and you know the evidence you've provided and it's hidden, disregarded, pushed to one side, that must really make you question what's going on.
Yes, and I think that particularly when you when we talk about the subject of UFOs, that's where that sort of comes in, because it's, I think it's, you know, the sort of official bodies, it becomes, you know, they'll either confirm or deny. But I always look at it that when you just have to look up to the sky and, you know, the planets in the universe. If there's a planet out there that made technological advances quicker than we did, and they can sort of move around, they've probably just come down. Actually, probably a guided tour. They've probably just come down to look at us and laugh for a bit and then just go. But to say that there's no chance of anything out there, I think, well, I don't accept that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't accept that. And for the simple reason, too many people have seen too many things.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of leads me on as well to one of my more... It's one of the stories that I've always given massive credence to, which is the Alan Godfrey case, if you're aware of this. Alan Godfrey was a police officer in Todmorden, who had a couple of weird incidents in 1980.
Is this Stokeway? Am I?
No,
where's Todmorden?
Todmorden is North Yorkshire.
Right, okay. Sorry.
And Alan was a police officer, and there'd been a mysterious death about 6 months before. He's always said that he doesn't think the two incidents are connected. But about 6 months later, he ended up on a strange call out that basically a herd of cows had got loose in the village, and so Alan was dispatched to try and help round them up, and on his way there he encountered a unidentified flying object hovering above the road, and he lost 40 minutes of time.
Right. Yeah.
And it's become one of the most well-known, well, it's probably the best alien abduction case that we've got in the UK. It's probably, and Alan, you know, nearly 40 years on, has always stuck to his story. He's never elaborated it. He's basically said this happened. But he felt that after he'd reported it, because he was, you know, he came out in the press. If you look into this story, it was massively reported in the press at the time. There'd been books and everything about it. In fact, Alan's just released a book, I think himself, last year about the whole thing, which is brilliant. I recommend it highly. But he had that kind of attitude after, because of what he'd been so public about it, that he basically felt that there then became a campaign to sort of move him out of the force.
Right. Yeah, and then of course you say, well, why on earth would Alan sort of make that up? Mm. And I know my colleague from the Aldridge incident, although he got to Chief Inspector, he always felt that, you know, sort of challenging held him back a little bit. You know, there was always, it puts a question mark over you in some people's eyes, because you've reported something that's just out of the ordinary. So Alan's probably suffered from the same thing. But why would Alan, why would he put his own reputation and career on the line and go through all that if he didn't have to?
Absolutely. I mean, that's why I always, like we were saying right at the beginning of this conversation, you're looking at things in a balanced, you know, sceptical manner. But once you look at what's happened and the people involved, it's very difficult to, you know, try and explain certain things away.
Yeah, absolutely. It is, and it's like the Castle Vale incident. That's a UFO, obviously at ground level.
Yeah,
but it's not in the book. But you look around there. There's going back, there are abduction cases in that area as well.
Yeah.
But because it's, I think it's pre-internet, you can only get very brief details. But you can't, you know, again, that's, you know, the officers that saw that, you know. That was a very strange, unidentified object that was flying around at ground level. And also in the next book, I've got an unidentified flying object in a warehouse. And again, I won't turn
nope,
this, but
yeah.
Lo and behold, the men in suits come along and take the video, and then everything is denied. You know, what video?
Oh dear. I mean, since you've started all this, has it kind of opened your mind not that I'm suggesting you were closed in any way, Andy, but has it kind of made you think, blimey, there's even more to this than I ever thought possible?
Yes, I always had an open mind, but I think it's been opened even more now. And I don't, I find it sort of, I think in some ways it's quite comforting that there's, you know, there's a whole world beyond this world. And I had an open mind, and now it's even more wide open. And yeah, there's lots of things we don't know.
It's a dangerous path, so welcome to the gang. Once you open the veil, Andy, there's plenty of rabbit holes to avoid falling down. So my apologies if that's how it ends up. So brilliant. So in regards to the second volume, are you looking at, when are you planning to have the second volume out?
Hopefully in the summer. I'm just waiting for responses from a few associations, and I've still got a few people who are who told me stories, and they're saying, "Well, I've heard the story verbally. Now they're writing their own statement out, so to speak." And then there's an awful lot of putting it into context and doing the historical research, and then obviously the proofreading that seems to go on forever. Hopefully in the summer I'll have another book that people will find interesting out.
Well, if it's anything like the first one, I will guarantee reader satisfaction, because I absolutely loved it, like I said. Obviously, we'll look forward to that coming out, and hopefully when it comes out, we'll arrange another chat and go through that, because I can't wait for that second volume. I'm thoroughly looking forward to that. I'll put that on my wish list. So, Andy, where can they find your first book and anything else about you, in regards to you and your website and anything like that?
It's on Amazon. It's available in Kindle and in paperback. I'm on Facebook, Andy Gilbert Books. There was a picture on my face on the Amazon page that wasn't me. I keep asking them to take it off. That's not me. That's a different Andy Gilbert who wrote some books. He's American. So I've had a bit of a spat with them about that. I'll have to double check, actually. That reminds me. I'm on Andy Gilbert Books. If people want to contact me, they can send me a message there. I'm on Twitter as well, but I tend to moan about the state of the politics and various local football teams on there.
I always tell. I am on Twitter, but please don't follow me if you don't like football, is what I usually say, because Twitter is my frustration bag for my team's sporting failures, which are not as bad as they could be, but still tends to annoy us. Listen, thank you so much for coming on. Like I say, I can't recommend the book Credible Witness high enough. It's a fabulous read. Like I say, I bought 3 copies and gave it to everybody, whether they wanted it or not. Everybody's loved it that I've given it to. And I wish you all the very best of success for the new launch. And we'll hopefully speak to you over the summer.
Yep. Thanks for your support. I really appreciate it. And I'll speak to you in the next one's out.
Andy, thank you for your time and your trouble. All the very best, and stay safe. Paul. All the best. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.